Hello, motion picture brains. That's you, fans of light, darkness, composition, fairy lords. There's the one. Welcome back to another episode of the Through the Lens podcast, the unedited audio of our full conversation with one of the world's most dynamic cinematographers. In this episode, we spoke with the very romantic Salvatore Totino, known for, amongst other things, the films of Any Given Sunday, Changing Lanes, The Da Vinci Code, Cinderella Man, Frost Nixon, and People Like Us. Yes, this is Ron Howard, cinematographer, and an amazing guy. What follows is the uncut audio of my conversation with Sal. He told us to call him Sal. We met him in Studio City, Los Angeles, California, at the apartment of Michael May in July 2012. Michael May, you rock our boxers, baby. We love you. We also have to mention that the ever-enthusiastic Alexis Green was the only person on set for this. We had two cameras that didn't actually match. And not being a professional photographer or sound recordist, she was swimming in technical issues that eventually only Sal could solve. So we have to thank Sal and give a big old aww to Alexis. You okay with that? If you want to check out the Hollywood video version of this interview, you will find it at craftart.com as Season 1, Episode 5 of Through the Lens, or youtube.com/craftart. You can also subscribe if you just happen to be in the neighborhood. It should be noted that during this interview, Sal made his pasta from scratch.
Exactly.
This is going to be fun.
If you did the research, you would have known.
Oh, I know. Affirmative action?
Yeah.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. New York State Policeman's Exam.
Wait, back up.
You want to just get going?
We're getting going. I'll do a little introduction, and then we'll let it rip. Okay.
Okay. Well, all right. After the introduction, we have to pause for it so I can step out. I only live here, so I have to leave.
Okay. Actually, I don't even see we pause. I see we just let you walk out. We just talk about what he looks like walking out.
Exactly.
Honestly, we want to make this very conversational. So okay. It should be exactly like this.
So this podcast is tough, so I don't have to worry about my language.
Not at all.
Okay, good.
Not at all. You do not have to worry about your language. In fact, if you do worry about your language, I'm going to be upset.
All right, we're going to go.
Okay.
Oh, hold on.
Oh, hold on.
Uh-oh. Oh, no. Busy setting everything else up.
Oh, shit.
Fucking card in the camera.
You're out of the union. You're out of the union.
That's an issue.
She didn't put a card in the camera.
Oh, that's very good.
It doesn't usually help.
No comment.
No, I mean, you guys.
We look at it. Some people look at it as a problem. We see it as an opportunity to get more creative.
There you go.
Are we still mic'd and boomed on him properly? Yeah, we're fine.
Yeah, that's over my head.
It's a little cloud.
It's like, yeah, that's not working good.
You don't think so?
No.
You think it's just going to sound like shit?
What do I know about sound?
What do you? It's true. Talkies? What's this whole talkie thing?
Where in Toronto are you from?
Smith and Hoyt. No, I'm kidding. I am from Bathurst and Lawrence.
Lawrence and what?
Bathurst. It's the Jewish ghetto.
Right.
Jewish ghetto. You probably have.
I was there for 8 months.
I know, you were shooting Cinderella Man.
Yeah.
I know, because I was making my first feature when you guys had half of PS loaded out of the.
Oh my God, I remember that.
Yeah, it was really, like, PS was like, why is everything moved over to this one rack? Well, that's just one project. And we're like, what fucking project is that?
Oh,
it's called Cinderella Man. And I was like, surely they have the title wrong. That's not the title of the movie, right? It can't be called Cinderella Man.
I know. That was a big mistake.
But they did that thing with AMC where they offered free tickets, they said AMC in Eastern Canada. Okay, we can roll.
I would clap, too, just to sync up.
Do you want to clap for us now? Let's do it. Here we go.
All right.
There's two of them now. So now the person's going to try to sync it. Welcome back to another regularly special episode of Through the Lens. And we are genuinely honored today to have with us somebody who I thought was Salvatore Totino. But now I understand, having met you for about 5 minutes, it's Sal. You're Sal.
Well, everybody calls me Sal.
Right.
Yeah, my proper name is Salvatore.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, New York.
Italian family.
Mm-hmm. Parents immigrated from Italy.
Oh, so you're first generation.
First generation American. My first language was Italian, actually.
Your first, okay. So, well, let's start off with this. Mm. I'm sitting in a theater, I think it was 2000, maybe 1999, 2000.
Mm.
And this movie that we went to go see because, you know, college, you know, high school, we were football fans. We were movie fans. We were Oliver Stone fans. And we go see this movie hits the screen, Any Given Sunday, one of the most aggressive, you know, action loaded and at the same time heavily dramatic sports movies ever made. And in it is, you know, some small actors, Al Pacino, Jamie Foxx, Cameron Diaz, Dennis Quaid. I'm probably missing another.
And Margaret.
Can't forget Margaret. And Margaret playing Cameron Diaz.
My generation. Yeah.
And this is a, if I'm not mistaken, first time.
This is my first feature film, yes.
First feature film. Yeah. So, you know, it's probably been asked to you by many people. If it hasn't been asked to you, it's been asked about. So how did that happen? How did that come about?
Well, you know, as you know, Oliver was working with Bob Richardson for the longest time.
Yeah.
Bob wasn't available for that film.
Mm-hmm.
So Oliver has a very good relationship with my agent and asked him to recommend some young, new DPs.
Mm-hmm.
And my agent sent over a bunch of reels, including my own, and Oliver liked my my work. And I went in for a couple of interviews while I was interviewing a few other people and got lucky.
Well, I mean, it's just...
Got lucky. It was like pulling a draft.
Right.
You know, you say you got lucky, but it was also the first day of principal photography, Oliver looked at me and said, "Welcome to Vietnam." And that's what I meant by pulling the draft. It's like, was this a good thing or not, you know?
Either that or did you think you were, like, still on the set of Heaven and Earth or one of his other...
No. What he meant by that is, like, look,
right.
You are either going to survive...
Sink or swim.
Or you're going to die.
Right.
You know, that's going to be all up to you. Well, when he said that, I walked away. I was like, what the fuck's he talking about? And in the next couple of weeks, I've come to realize what that was about.
And what was it about?
You know, it was about surviving. You know, it was like trying to find a way to be creative while being pulled back on every single angle possible.
How are you? Okay,
and so, Oliver would do odd things, you know, like he'd call on his way to set and say, "Hey, I want to shoot this scene, blah, blah, blah." Al walking out the door, and I'm like, "Well, that's not on the schedule. It's not even in the script, you know?" He's like, "Don't tell me. You set everything up for that." So I'm set up for that, and then.
So it's like improv.
He would come on set, and he'd be like, "What is this?" So you just told me on the phone. He said, "Didn't you read the script? The schedule was supposed to be inside. You know, you just wasted 20 minutes." So it's like, okay, so now this is what it's going to be like.
Right.
So, you know, you're constantly dodging bullets and figuring it out and trying to come up with, you know, an
interesting
approach.
But there's a method to that madness, or was it just madness?
At that time, I think it was a little bit of madness. Look, Oliver, I have a lot of respect for him. He's a genius.
Right.
The man's very smart.
Clearly.
And, you know, we all have our time.
Right. Yeah. So I saw the movie in the theater. Haven't seen it since again. Never rented it. The scenes that jump out to me from memory, LT sawing a car in half, this crazy aggressive angle, you know, and just sparks flying all over the place and stuff like that, night exterior, scenes in Al Pacino's character's house with Jamie Foxx where he's making him lunch, a jambalaya or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and you have Lawrence of Arabia, or no, Ben-Hur.
Ben-Hur.
In the background, on the plasma screen in the background. And it's like, how do you make a two-hander into something, you know, with the level of a war movie, you know, aggressively done, you know, just like at constant, you know.
Well, that's all of his brilliance right there.
Right, right. And then, okay, there's a rumor, I just want you to know if you can confirm it or not. The scene where, you know, it's Al Pacino's halftime speech, is it, you just get the focus puller to grid the floor and Al's going to go wherever he's going to go, or does he actually keep to whatever the marks are?
Al goes where Al wants to go.
Okay.
He's incredible to work with.
I can only imagine.
I love Al.
So what was, tell us a little bit about that, just about, like, you know, your first time DPing and seeing Al Pacino work. Is it just like...
You know, I've always respected and looked up and to Al and his work. Has been such a big influence, all of his films that growing up, you know, The Godfather, Bobby Deerfield, I mean, you know, just going out,
right.
Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, I could just go on.
Yeah, on.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So you kind of so, like, pinch, you know, me, I'm dreaming, I'm
exactly.
Lighting up.
You know, and I'll be on set, and, you know, my back towards the door, and I'll walk on set, and just tap me on the back and say, "Hey, Sally boy, how you doing?" Call me Sally Boy.
You must have called your mom and told her.
And I would still feel like that today if I worked with him. You know?
Right. We'll see you later.
Good. Good luck, guys.
Bye.
We're losing one cameraman, so if this angle changes, there's something funny going on.
That one's just on you.
Yeah, it's just on me. It's really not the one. We got the nice lens and the nice body on that over there. Yeah, I'm serious. look, compare them. Anyway, so let's go back in time. You are growing up in Brooklyn in a rough neighborhood. What gets you into cinematography? How did that happen?
I'll try to keep it short.
Yeah.
My family, you either went to college or you learned to trade. And when I was young, I wasn't doing so well in school, and they encouraged me to go to a trade high school, where I started picking up my grades, and I started doing really well in math, and I took college-bound classes, and I wound up going to college for engineering. 2.5 years of that, I was like, oh, my God, so boring. I quit. I went to work for an electrical contractor. And I just tried to figure myself out. And one summer, I was about to start taking, I took the New York City policeman's exam because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And in doing, this is 1985. And in doing so, I got two questions wrong. I scored a 95.
Okay.
And I remember I got a wait list number in around 7,200s. And after you take your written exam, you go and get a physical, and you already have your wait list number. And I met this kid, this Puerto Rican kid, who got a 75. And he was like 3,100 something. I just remember that, you know. And he was going into the first academy in July of 85.
So you were like,
I was like, what? Okay, affirmative action. That's what affirmative action is. So I was scheduled to go in January 86. Mm-hmm. That summer, I was contemplating taking some photography classes. The idea of making a living as an artist in my house did not...
Your father was a...
Well, actually, my father's a hairdresser, I believe.
He's a hairdresser. Okay, there's some art involved in that, for sure. Okay.
You know Tony Sirico on The Sopranos, Paulie? Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's my dad's work.
Yeah. Really?
And that's just by coincidence, him, Tony Sirico going into my dad's shop in the neighborhood with my father. Yeah. That's a whole other story.
So you were involved in movies. In a long
so
time.
So I was going to start taking some photography classes, and yeah. I met somebody at a...
As a kid, were you fooling around with cameras?
No, never?
No, never.
There was one class in junior high school that we all had to take. And
So you're 20 years old, and you go, I'd like to take some photography classes.
21.
21.
Okay. But I didn't take them.
Didn't take them?
No. What happened was I met somebody who was in the film business, and then I went and saw him at work one day. I was like, wow, I was just enthralled by the whole thing. And he said, look, if you want to get in the business, you have to become a PA and quit your job. And so next day I quit my job, and I went looking for work as a PA, and I wound up going to work for the company where he worked, and I wound up staying there for a year and a half. And in the meantime, I had bought myself a still camera. I taught myself how to print black and white.
And the math part of your mind now is liking the fact that a stop up and a stop is like a...
It's kind of like that.
Right.
You know, I never, like... took it so mathematically. You know, I think the mathematical aspect of it is a very good foundation that you need to know.
Right.
But you need to be free about it.
Uh-huh.
It's like a recipe. You know, you're cooking a dish. You could follow it down to the last gram, or you could put a little bit of your soul into it.
So you would say you light very much. I love the analogy to cooking. Yeah. You're saying you light and shoot very much with, if it doesn't feel right, it doesn't matter what the...
Yeah.
Right.
You know, it's, rules are there to be broken. And sometimes they're broken and they're wonderful, and sometimes you're like, why did I do that for?
You push the limits?
I remember once I was doing a commercial with Alex Proyas for Nesty.
Right.
And we finished...
Alex Proyas on a Nesty commercial. With the robots?
No. It's actually really interesting.
Was it about the end of the world and the only one left is Nesty?
There was one spot that was like a take on Brazil.
Okay.
Which was interesting. And then there was another spot, like Brazil meets S&M. And then there was another spot, I forget what it was. And we finished the Brazil type spot.
Yeah.
And we had a little extra time. And we moved over to the next set. And I was lighting this stage. It was like a theatrical set. I was lighting it very dark. And Alex is like, wow, it's really dark. I said, yeah. He goes, how dark is it? I said, I don't know. I haven't gone this far yet. And I said, are you okay with that? He said, well, yeah, you know, if it's no good, then we have time tomorrow to reshoot it. I said, okay. So, you know, it's like, how are you ever going to know the limits of film if you don't push the film?
Right.
So the next
you're shooting at the time on what, 200 speed stock?
I was shooting 5293. 200. Okay.
That was the one with stock. The pastels that they used in AI. It was really nice skin tones.
I don't know if they used it. It's got nice skin tones. Okay, yeah. I used to use it a lot back then. I loved that stock.
Yeah.
And the next day, Alex saw the film before I did, and I came in the stage. He said, "So you found the edge and you fell off." Yeah. And it's just wonderful to have that
experience,
and then you know how far you can go with it.
That's a great story.
But if I'm going to be so technical about it all the time, how would I even know how far that film can go?
Well, I think it was Willis who said. He was talking about The Godfather. He said, I went too far a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And then he followed that up with, I think Rembrandt went too far a couple times too.
Yeah.
That's a great story. So you shoot Any Given Sunday. We're flashing forward now. So you start getting jobs, and you start getting jobs on music videos and then commercials, and then you get hired on Any Given Sunday. And you're like, pinch me, I'm dreaming. Mm-hmm. But you made it through.
Oh, yeah, I made it through. I lost 22 pounds, and I did not want to do a feature film after that.
You did? That's it, I'm not doing it.
I was like, if they're all going to be like this, I'm not interested.
What changes?
Um, 2001, I think it is. Raj Mishal and Scott Rudin. Scott Rudin sends Changing Lanes. And I love the whole opening and Changing Lanes, which is not in the film, actually. It was this whole... Yeah, it's a whole opening where there's, there's hawks in New York City.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, there's hawks in the city. You'd be surprised if it's summer in Toronto. Yeah. And in the opening, there's a pigeon flying, and this hawk comes out of nowhere and just kills it in the middle of the air. And the blood sort of falls down, and we follow the blood, and it happens to land on the coffin that they're bringing into the church for that funeral, Ben Affleck's father-in-law's funeral.
What a beautiful image.
And I was just...
How did you shoot that?
We didn't. It didn't even... By the time we got to...
Camera.
Yeah, that went away. That opening went away.
But that was... when you got the script, that was what...
Yeah.
You were like, oh.
And I, Roger's very opposite of Oliver.
British director,
theatrical training, very much about the actors.
Right.
Very collaborative. His cards were on the table. You didn't know. You knew exactly what was happening. You didn't have to second guess. You didn't look over your shoulder. You didn't have to worry about any of that. And it was a great experience. It was such a lovely experience.
I think it was...
And I loved doing that movie.
Right.
I gave it sort of an interesting look at the time. A little bit of a 70s kind of grit to it.
Mm-hmm. How much do you play around before, because it was just moving into another thing. Not one of your two movies looks the same. There is not one of your two movies that looks the same. I've seen all of your movies, or most of them, I think I've seen all of them. There's one or two that I haven't seen. I haven't seen that yet.
It's just have to go see People Like Us.
Kurtzman and Orchy. So we got to talk about that in a second. But I think I've seen most of your movies, and none of them look the same. I mean, the way I always refer to...
Can we hold on?
Yeah, sure.
No problem. We can't.
She's like, oh, I forgot to roll sound.
Yeah, I forgot to roll sound. I didn't put a card in the camera. I'm sorry.
I mean, at what point did you know? All right, I'm gonna ask. At what point did you know you had an incredible talent? Because I mean, you can't look at your own work and not go, "Yeah, I'm a damn good cinematographer." You can't look at it and go, "I mean, some people beat themselves up." You aren't, There's two types of artists: the ones that spend the rest of their life flogging themselves, and the ones that get on and try and improve. You know what I mean? And you just strike me as you have such a workmanlike mentality about what you do. Go ahead.
We're back.
Are we still rolling?
We're back, yeah.
Do you need to clap again?
You need to.
Okay, let's clap again.
Bam! Sal Tatino. That's how you do a slate. You have such a workmanlike mentality, it seems to me, to your stuff. I mean, are you ever wanting to play the role of the artist more or less? I mean, like, it just doesn't even occur to you? I mean,
it doesn't occur to me. I don't think of playing an artist.
You just
I find something that I really like to do material-wise and put myself into it.
Mm-hmm. So the way I refer to Cinderella Man is I say it's the best movie Roger Deakins never shot.
Yeah.
I mean, period piece, right? You know, this is this classic argument about period pieces. You know, well, we know that going back they had less light, therefore they should be, you know, yeah. They should be brighter, they should be dark, whatever. That movie to me, there wasn't one frame of Cinderella Man where there is drifting across Russell Crowe's apartment after the Depression hit. You know, beginning of the movie, he's on top of the world. And it flashes forward and we drift across the apartment. It's very dim. There's no light. You know, it's just, there's nothing. He's impoverished. Or the huge crowd with all these hats and all these long coats. Or Giamatti's empty, sparse apartment. Mm. You know, I mean, none of it. There wasn't one shot in the movie that felt like it wasn't part of this perfectly designed whole, you know, that you'd constructed this full world and every scene just sort of linked into that world. And, so what was your plan going in?
Thank you. Well, the plan was to really try to make the audience feel as though they were there. Right. So, for example, in Russell's apartment, I went through very painstaking steps not to remove walls. It was a set to work out lensing so that we were in the room. So there was only one time I took a wall out to get behind so I could come across the table. Other than that, I really tried not to. And then my crew was starting to get a little frustrated because there was only one door in and out. So we agreed to open a wall in a closet in the back to get equipment in and out.
So this was your commitment
to try to make the audience really feel what it felt like to be in that apartment.
Right.
And it forced me to be on certain lenses because of the distances that I needed to be. So, you know, sometimes it might not have been as flattering if I had the distance to go on a longer lens. I think that really comes out in the film,
yeah,
and also in the boxing. I was in the ring.
Talk about shooting boxing, because this is something that, like, you know, I think if I was, I'm not a DP, but if I was, I'd be scared out of my mind. Because, like, you know, everyone thinks of Raging Bull, but then, you know, every DP has done boxing at some, you know.
Look at Raging Bull, and, you know, it was very innovative for the time.
Of course.
But when you go frame by frame, the punches are pretty far off, you know, and... You know, Ron was like, okay, how are we going to do the boxing?
Right.
And we went to a gym out here in the valley way before and just got some video cameras. And, you know, I said, Ron, we'll just get in the ring with the cameras. He said, well, how are you going to get in with the cameras? You know, the actor's going to get hurt. You're going to get hurt. I said, no, it won't. I said, I think we could do this. And we did a little test with some video cameras here in the valley. It kind of worked out. But he's like, but those are small cameras. And I'm like, look, you know I can do it. When we're in prep, let's do some tests. And that's what we did in prep. I got in the ring with Russell and another boxer. We studied the choreography first, and I move around the choreography with them without the camera so they could see where I was, I could see where they were going. And it was like doing a dance. Yeah, it's like doing a dance.
Let's talk about lighting. The movie. Is it just every scene you just get in, you figure out are you figure out the framing first and light second, or is it work together?
You know, I do a lot of prep in pre-production, you know, scouting locations with the director, and then afterwards going back with my crew and talking about the sets and what I'm thinking and where I want the light to come from. So on the day, I'm pretty much roughed in. Very rarely do I go, no, let's just scrap this all and do it differently.
Right.
You know, because you are telling the story.
Because there are some DPs who do that.
Yeah, there are. But, you know, I'll make a commitment. And afterwards, I don't always make the right choice. And afterwards, I'll look at it and go, fuck, no, we should have done that differently.
If there is, there's probably... However, 10, 12 guys watching this, whoever, our mothers, really nice to hear you say that, because a lot of times people just don't admit to that. You know what I mean?
But it's the truth. Yeah. Again.
Oh, fuck. I'm sorry. Oh, Alexis.
I'm an angel. to shut up and I'll talk to you guys again for this.
She's great, right?
It's good. We have to do the clapping again.
No more clapping.
No more clapping. Oh, because that's been rolling the whole time, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, we're so
okay.
So, what was the first? I don't know. Let me just look here. How did you get introduced to Ron?
Ron's producer, Todd Hollowell, mm-hmm. had seen Any Given Sunday. Todd always likes to tell a story how he bought a ticket. He always likes to say he buys tickets to movies.
Right.
And he went, after the movie was over, he went out, bought another ticket, and went back in and saw it again. So he was trying to convince Ron, you know, for a right job to hire me. And the Alamo came up, and I think they had somebody else on who fell out. So they interviewed me for the Alamo, and I was going to do the Alamo with Ron. And then Ron fell out of the Alamo, and we parted ways. You know, a couple of months later, he called out of the blue and said, hey, I got this film called The Missing. You want to do it? So I did The Missing with him.
And then since then, you did, what, six films with him?
Six films. Including The Missing, yeah.
Including The Missing.
Mm-hmm.
And was that must have just, I mean, he was known, if I'm not mistaken, for doing a lot of different movies with different cinematographers.
He would
move around a lot, quite a bit, right?
Yeah. He's worked with Mikhail Solomon twice, and I think he would have continued working with Mikhail. Mikhail moved on to directing. Mm-hmm. He really likes Mikhail. And maybe one other cinematographer as well. There was somebody else in there, too.
That he didn't use twice. But he tends to...
We have a great, honest relationship.
Right.
And a collaborative relationship. And it's very open. And I really appreciate that.
Well, you kind of see the same thing with... and I've never spoken with Janusz Kaminski, but whoa, we got all kinds of, we're taking multiple exposures here.
Janusz right now, if he was here, he'd be bouncing all over the place.
he wouldn't be able to sit still?
Yeah, he's very energetic. he's a brilliant man.
Sorry, I'm not getting it to record.
Yeah.
Mikey didn't show me how to use the camera before. I only know how to use the red one.
Okay, here we go. Sal's getting in there. That's it. He's going to make it work.
I just need to
look at this. Look at this.
Just hit
right now, Salvatore Tatino.
Yeah, it's recording. You hit the record button and it records.
An expert who knows how to use a Canon Rebel T4i.
Oh, that's a Rebel T4i.
I love the
Why
fact that you literally...
Why did you use a 5D Mark III?
Because we're using a Scarlett.
Okay.
And so this was just our backup body, which is basically a 7D. And in Canada...
Compression sucks.
It's terrible, yes. Canon. Compression sucks. That's our spot for...
No.
The 5D Mark III is outstanding.
Yeah, it's a good camera.
Anyway, so let's talk a little bit about cameras, actually, film versus mm-hmm. digital. You know, I mean, I've heard every attitude across the board, purists to not, you know, not scared of technology, not scared of technology. Mm-hmm. I don't want to. I mean, if I had to venture a guess, which I don't because you're here, mm-hmm. but if I had to venture a guess, I would think your attitude is, you know, these are changing things, and pictures are pictures, and they each have their own qualities that they bring to the table.
That's true, but I want to hold on to film as long as I can.
Oh, you do? Okay, so you're
only because it is going to go away.
Right.
And I do love it so much. It's more alive, where digital is more clean and antiseptic. It doesn't feel like it's like a living
organic
organism.
Right.
Yeah. Where film does to me. So, I like film for that aspect. I also like the fact that, you know, you're wondering, what am I going to see tomorrow from yesterday?
It's that mystery.
And, you know, the digital thing is a lot of times, well, especially on commercials now, there's too many cooks in the kitchen.
Right.
And there's too many.
Your data manager, your color, onset color.
Yeah, but too many people have a comment on it, and it takes away from telling a story or having one's vision.
So you're saying that because, if I'm hearing you correctly, that, you know, when you're shooting film, you're telling the client, the producer, the ad agency, by the way, that's not necessarily what it looks like. And I know what it looks like, and you know.
Yeah, and you're telling them that because they're looking at a videotape that is, you know, through a prism, so they're not getting a great quality image.
Right.
So you're saying, hey, look, this is going to look like this, and yes.
And that mystery is doing you a favor because they're not chiming in about change this, change that.
Well, yeah.
Whereas with digital,
and the thing about it is there's so much, even with film, that they can do after IntelliCine to change the look. And it is their film. In the end, it's the ad agency's film. They can do what they want with it, and I respect that. But with the digital, there is so much to play with as well and afterwards. But they're, you know, so involved in it now, and then afterwards they change it again anyway.
Right.
You know, so it's just, I'd rather just keep working.
Right. Got it. Yeah. Frost versus Nixon.
No, it's not Frost versus Nixon.
Sorry.
Frost Nixon.
Thanks.
Okay. There's no verse in there.
Right. Okay. Let's take that one again. Just because it's going to look
No, it's good. I like that.
Exactly.
We're not going back.
All right. The problem is there's another movie being made right now called Elvis versus Nixon.
That's
what got in my head.
Okay.
Frost Nixon.
Frost Nixon.
Frank Langella.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That movie, again, as I said before, none of your two movies look the same. That movie, it almost felt like everything photographically was heading, building into the footage between them in the interview. That it was like, that the aesthetic of it was moving towards... Hmm. That reveal. Is that coming out of my brain?
It's the first time I heard that. That's interesting.
That's just the way it just felt like it had a look to it that you were capturing, you know, this documenting this thing, almost like a newsreel that's moving along, and then it just barrels into can this guy do it? Can he actually pull him out of that cell? I mean,
well, you know, in a way, it was also like Cinderella Man,
right?
That movie, because it's about these two opponents training to battle each other,
right?
And you know, that was often used as an analogy while we're
oh really
yeah.
So, if I'm not mistaken, that was
a boxing match. You know, Ron's like, how are we gonna make these interviews not feel boring?
Right,
it's because I said, like a boxing match.
Did he? It was a play.
It was a play, yes.
That he had seen on Broadway.
Yes,
and then said, I want to make a movie of this.
I don't know how it came about.
Okay. But when you got the script...
Oh, you read the material and you immediately fell in love with it.
That's fantastic. Did you go back and read, like, the original play just to see, or did you just stick
with it? No, we actually went and saw the play.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, yeah.
So what...
Which is so different.
It's completely different. So
very different.
What does that do for you as a photographer, and you're going, okay, I got to translate this story now. I got to take the story and move it into this medium. Obviously, there's a script. But what does it do for you to see the play? Like,
Nothing. It was great entertainment. Yeah. It was a great way to see who the actors were and how their performances were. But I did not let any of that environment, the lighting, the sets, any of that get in my head.
Right.
You know,
because that's
a different story
that's
being told. It's being told differently than the way we were going to tell it on film. It's being told in the theater, and it needs to be told a certain way. And
got it. People Like Us, your latest film.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orci, two of the highest, most regarded writers working in the business right now. And they go, we want Sal.
Alex, they had another DP in mind,
mm-hmm.
but they wanted to interview me. I read the material. I fell in love with the material. It really resonated with me. I related to it right away. And I went into the interview with Alex, and I came in like a firecracker.
I was just so excited.
And I had not like I'm shooting this movie, but more like how excited I was about the material, my ideas on, you know, how I wanted to approach it. And a lot of the ideas, Alex, we immediately hit it off. And it was funny because when I left, I called my agent. She's like, how'd it go? I go, I think it went well, but I think they're probably going to think I was high or something because I just didn't stop talking. And I was like animating with my hands and everything. And by the time I got home, drove from Universal all the way over to the west side of town, my agent called back and said they were offering you the movie. And I was really excited about it. It was definitely one of my best experiences working on that film.
Were both Alex and Roberto on set the whole time, or were they working like the Coen brothers?
No. Okay. Roberto was out. You know, he came by once or twice. It was Alex's movie.
Alex's movie, okay.
Alex directed the film.
And obviously for him, I mean, it's...
You know, it's based on a true story.
Right.
And true events. You know, unfortunately, there's a little suggestion in some of the media now that it's just horrible that they just try to put this target on his back. And, you know, because it is different than what he's done. He's done an amazing, amazing film. Right. It's his first film.
Right.
He's taken a personal story and made it so accessible to everybody. And that it just, you know, gets some of the critics are just, I don't know what they're thinking. You know, it takes a lot of fucking balls to take a personal story and to actually bring it to fruition.
To actualize it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people can say very they few. Do that?
Yeah.
Right?
Because most of the time when people want to tell an extremely personal story, that they're either too close to it, so that what they put out there is interesting to them, but nobody else.
Yeah.
Or it's reinvented to such a degree that, you know, you get criticized for reinventing it too much. Yeah. You know?
Look, he fictionalized the movie.
He has to.
And he had to do it.
Yeah.
But it also caused a lot of friction in his family, too.
Right.
You know, so that's a very difficult task to overcome. And he did an amazing job.
It sounds like you were very, not only was it a partnership to work on that movie, but you're very proud of him.
I'm very proud of him. And I could say that not only being very proud of him, I made a great friend in the film, a great collaborator, somebody who I had tremendous respect for.
Uh-huh.
And I'd go anywhere with him.
Fantastic.
Go to any battle.
As far as
Oliver would put it.
It's kind of funny. We're talking about your last movie, your first movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about your I'm curious to hear your approach to the word naturalism. Some photographers hold up naturalism as this holy grail of photography, and others,
like what? Give me an example. What sense?
That you know, if we're lighting or shooting, it's got to be look naturalistic. It's got to look, you know, and that anything else outside of that is kind of, you know, it's fine, but it's not achieving the purest essence of what photography should be.
Well, I think that depends on the story.
Right.
And what the story is calling for. You know, Frost Nixon, even people like us, I went through, you know, a lot of difficulty to make it feel natural. I lit, and when we had a set, I lit the set from outside like it would be lit from in an apartment or house during the day. I wanted to have that natural kind of feeling. But if I was doing something like, you know, I did Radiohead's Fake Plastic Trees video, that was something that was very stylized.
Right.
And that's what it called for.
Right.
It called for something to be stylized. Or you two staring at the sun, it was something that needed to be stylized. You know, I think it's all about what the material says and needs to be.
So when it comes to telling the story, what you're saying is beautiful. When it comes to telling the story, how much of that affects, you know, if you have in your mind like shot listed or prepped or whatever for, you know, each scene, but then you get there and you see the actors in the space and you see the blocking or you see. Sometimes you just go, you know what, really, I need to put the camera here. I need to use this lens instead of that lens.
Yeah, sometimes that happens.
Okay.
You know, you have to be free to just change things up.
Yeah. How much of what you do is about the art and how much of it is about working with other people?
Ooh, that's a tough one. That's a tough one because it's a fine line. You can't be an artist if you're not willing to work with other people.
Right.
So working with people is very important to be able to bring your art forward. And there's times that you're able to bring it forward more so than others.
What type of demeanor do you try and?
I have a collaborative demeanor. I like to work together. I'm a hard worker. I like to have a very comfortable environment to work in. I have a consistent crew that I really respect, that we work very hard together. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that there is a mutual respect there as well, because that just helps. It helps tell the story. It helps make the day go good. And we have a lot of fun while we're doing it. So, you know, to answer your question, I think it's probably 50-50. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that scale will shift one way or another, but, you know, it's important. Working with people is very important. You know, you could be a genius and you could be a fucking asshole. And, you know, sometimes it gets to a point where people are like, you know, life's too short.
Right.
And, I, you know, I don't want to be on a life's too short list.
Right.
I love what I do and I want to keep doing what I do.
Any particular types of stories that you haven't yet told that you'd like to tell? You know, I really like to. What kind of movie would Sal Tatino like to be?
You shooting? Know, I want to do like a Bourne Identity. I want to do a little Bond film. I would like to do like
espionage.
a good one. You right. know, it would be nice to do one. But I'm always very gravitated towards these personal stories. They mean a lot to me. I grew up in a whole Italian neorealism. Film world, you know, so it's all my parents
so
took
did.
Us to go see. It was
okay.
Fellini and Rossellini and De Sica and Visconti. You know, they only went to see Italian films, you know, unless I went on my own with my friends. So that's kind of what a family outing was. It was a little theater called the Walker Theater over on 18th Avenue on Sunday nights, Italian films, and we'd go see them. So, you know, I gravitate to stories like People Like Us and Frost Nixon, and Cinderella Man. They mean they carry more weight for me. I relate to it. You know, I get very emotional with those kind of films.
Do you get emotional on set?
I have, yeah. You know, I on People Like Us, twice, Michelle Pfeiffer made me cry. Not that she made me cry. I operate a camera, and during one of the performances, she's having a fight with her son, Chris Pine, and through the lens, I just felt it, that I just started to cry. The hair on my neck stood up, and I just started to cry, and it's just incredible when an actress or an actor can take you there, and it's not nothing that is, it's because they're doing a scene. It's nothing between you and them. It's just the scene that's taking place. And then another time, she apologizes to Chris and tells him sort of the truth and what happened. And in that moment, too, you know, it's just she's carrying the whole weight of the world on her, and you feel it. And you're in the room, and you almost feel like, I shouldn't be in this room right now.
Fantastic.
And it's just so wonderful. Or I'm looking at Frank Langella. And I forget, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm in the room with Nixon. They really made me feel like I was in the room with Nixon. And, you know, Russell Crowe got me emotional with when he went back to the boxing commission to ask for money.
Right.
You know, it was a very difficult scene, and you can understand that, and especially being a father and having children, you know, what would I do if I needed to feed my kids?
Was this almost like this black cloud that opened up? You know, over the actor in that moment, you know, like just like you feel the energy in the room going to this very sad, desperate
yes.
place.
Yeah, the energy you feel, and Russell commands it in a really amazing way.
And so when that moment's happening, does it go through your head at all, you know, man, I'm glad I did this with, you know, lighting.
No.
But at the end of the day.
No, I here we got to start.
There we go.
You guys are on a roll. I just want to switch out the red card before it's cut
you said
you
didn't have to do that again.
She lied.
I know. Well, you guys are just—you're talking longer than I thought you would. It's awesome.
You fucking lied to us.
I know I fucking
not
lied to you. I'm sorry.
What?
Not a fan of the right camera.
Please say that.
I'm not saying it.
You can't say it now. It's okay because we're recording this now, so we're just gonna put this on the podcast.
Yeah,
so find me and kick my ass. You probably could too. Be in time. You know what? I don't. You know I'm not a fan. I do think the Alexa looks beautiful. It's the first time where
I it's only because I love that they're very bravado and sort of broke the digital world.
Yeah.
I've had problems in the past when I've used them.
Yeah.
A couple of times, so.
Did you ever get forced to use like Reds? Like an epic?
Yeah, it's
on a job, really?
Yeah. It's happened. But not much lately.
These fucking things are so green, it's crazy.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't know that until after we got them.
You know, you gotta get them from Lightgear.
Lightgear.
Yeah, he's making them now. Color corrected.
Color corrected.
He makes LED tape. It's great. Aldemail.
LED tape.
And it's 1/4-inch thick. I'll tape it down.
You just tape it.
This is the, like that. You could tape
it
anywhere.
How much light does it throw?
Oh, it's very bright. And then you can even cut it with different size strips.
But then
it comes in a 35-foot roll. 12 volts. It's a little dimmer than that big. Plug it in or plug it in a camera battery.
But then how do you connect it to the tape? To the
just a little wire that connects it.
Just, and you can just
You can put it inside things. And oh, it's amazing what you can do with
so
it.
So you're just like loving this whole world.
Yeah.
It's, are you using a lot of LEDs on your new...
Yeah, sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah.
You know, they just don't have the punch. They don't have the throw.
No, they don't have the throw. Yeah. No, it's like this light that just sort of goes like...
Yeah. It's a great soft source.
Exactly, yeah. But it's... But it is... where do you see foresee a world where we're using... I mean, obviously, we foresee a world where we're shooting film very, very seldom.
Mm-hmm.
Do we foresee a world where we're shooting... a lot less actual tungsten and HMI bulbs than we're using?
I don't know.
Okay.
I can't answer that yet.
It's a technical thing. I mean, it's not
just, if they can get the technology, if they can get the LEDs to give you the throw of an 18K, you know, Arimax, then goodbye.
Yeah. It was fun. It's been fun while it lasted.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it was up until, it was interesting. I used to own Brood Arcs.
You used to own some.
Yeah.
That's when you know you're working a lot of commercials.
I love those lights.
The Maxi Broods.
No, Brood Arcs.
Oh, sorry.
Brood Arcs are a DC light that burns a carbon. And it's actual flame. And these are lights that are from the 40s and the 50s.
Oh, you're saying like a double arc lamp.
No, not a double arc. It's just a Brood Arc is the name of it. It's like a big Fresnel light.
Yeah.
And... And there's a rod that has one end of a positive and there's another one that has a negative, and you keep a certain gap that creates like a short and creates a flame.
What color temperature were these right now?
And you could, depending on the carbons, you could get daylight or tungsten carbons.
How big were these lamps?
They were the size of like a 20K Fresnel.
And heavy?
Yeah, heavy. Yeah. And you needed to have a DC generator. You need to have operators that knew how to operate something called trimming the arc.
Because
it has to feed the carbon as it's burning. It has to feed in. And then after a while, there's no more carbon, and you have to stop working. Trim the arcs. They open up the backs. They take out the little piece of carbon. They put in a new carbon. They burn it in, and then you get going again.
You own these lamps.
It's the closest light to the sun because it is an actual flame.
Right.
Yeah.
And you own these lamps.
I used to own them, yeah. Not anymore.
Oh, you got
rid of them. It's hard to get the carbons anymore. It's hard to get people that know how to operate them. You need a DC generator, and if you're mixing lights, then you need a DC and an AC generator. It adds cost to the production because you do need a man per light. So if you have 10 Brood Arcs, you got 10 men. You can't quite do that anymore, you know?
That's hilarious. Yeah. Not many photographers own their own... specialty instruments.
Yeah, it used to be. It was fun.
So you want to do, we just to recap, you know, you'd love to do a strong espionage film,
mm-hmm.
a Bourne type film. Anything else that's on your horizon, science fiction?
No, nothing. There's nothing on my horizon at the moment. There was a film that I was hoping that I interviewed for called August Osher County.
Mm-hmm.
John Wells is directing. It's based on a play in New York about a dysfunctional family in Oklahoma, near the Indian Reservation. And
mm-hmm.
Interesting story. It all kind of comes to head at one dinner table. And the mother, Meryl Streep, just kind of goes off on her kids. It's a film that I would like, you know, the material resonates with me. Yeah. Like
any words of it? Cool. Photographers who are watching, who admire your work, because there's many, who's, you know, what would you, I mean, aside from get out of my business so I get more work?
No, kidding. Not at all. You know, I like to see people get work over me, you know.
Right.
I think that's a good thing. You know what? Take chances. Take risks. Figure things out, you know, in the direction that you want to go, and take a chance and see how wonderful it could be or how horrible it could be, and learn from that and be good to other people.
Sal Tatino, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
It was fun.
Take care.